Yes.
Bear left.
What?
Bear left.
Right frog.
What?
Never mind.
That's cute.
Hello, Steven.
Hey, Quinn.
How are you doing today?
I'm good because it is the first recording of our new podcast, and that's an exciting day.
I am so excited to talk about the Muppets with you.
Yes.
And just really dive into their beautiful, near-perfect movie catalog.
It's great. We're going to go through it, and I think we have, you know, our high points and low points. But this started as a joke on Twitter months ago, and then we've been talking about it, and now here we are. So we will have an episode once a month or so covering all of the Muppet movies, including two made-for-TV movies that Jason Snell is making us do, and he's the boss.
Absolutely. We are not covering the Muppets TV show. This is the movies, partially because there's a lot more TV show and partially because Steven hasn't seen the TV show, apparently.
Only snippets of it. I'm ashamed. But I'm too young for that and to have really seen it in its heyday. And I kind of know what it was, but I definitely didn't live through it. So that's something I will correct over the course of this show.
Uh-huh. I've seen the Muppets. Just want to put that out there. You know, people make fun of me for being young a lot, but I do have some street cred out here with
pop
culture.
Yeah, Muppet street cred.
Exactly. Just because my dad likes the Muppets, but, you know, okay. That's fine.
Well, and you have that Gonzo tattoo.
Let's not talk about that.
Sorry. It's very realistic.
Well, today we are, of course, starting with the original The Muppet Movie.
Mm-hmm.
From way back in 1979.
Way back. I do have notes about when maybe the movie was set, because I don't think the movie is set in 79, but we can talk about that as we get there. But what's cool about this is it is the first full-length theatrical film featuring the Muppets. And one thing that really jumped out at me in watching is this movie is effectively two dozen little scenes. Like, different sets, different movements. It is a cohesive movie, and I love this movie. It may be my favorite Muppet movie, but it is really shot almost like a TV show in these little segments that kind of get strung along. Did that jump out at you?
I really noticed it in terms of the music in this movie, which I can't wait to really talk about, because there's a lot of different songs in it, and they do work with the plot, and it is a cohesive movie plot, but kind of each song is kind of its own music video, and so there's like a Muppets music video, and then they do some scenes, and then there's another Muppets music video, and like that's how I kind of felt the movie progressing along.
Interestingly, this was it was produced by Jim Henson, as you would imagine, but it wasn't directed by him or Frank Oz. They had an outsider. James Frawley directed this, and doing some reading online about the production of this movie, it sounded like it was kind of a rough production at points, that maybe there was some friction between the Muppet people and this director. And for years after this, Frank Oz or Jim Henson would direct the subsequent films.
Yeah, reading about that made me kind of sad, especially because there was a note that like most Muppet productions had a very good-natured set. And apparently this movie did not always have that same tone a lot of the time. And I was like, oh, that's kind of a bummer for that director who... I mean, I don't know what he did to antagonize Jim Henson, but there clearly was like some kind of conflict that occurred that made it not as fun for everyone, which is kind of sad because it's like such a lighthearted movie. But
it is. So we talked about how I don't have a ton of experience with the Muppet Show, but this started in that writing room with the writers of the Muppet Show, and it's meant to take place between or like halfway through the third season of the show. So there is some tie in there that we're going to learn how the Muppets got together, but it's it is distinct from the show. And as someone who hasn't seen a lot of the show, this you don't need to know really any history of the Muppets to get into this movie. You don't have to know they have these years of TV already under their fuzzy little belts. This is a standalone piece, and I think that's really smart the way they did that, because I mean the show was popular, but you know, putting something in the theater, you always have to work through like what are people's preconceived notions, what is their knowledge of this already, you know, kind of in their heads. And so like other movies we've seen adapted from other media, there's some explaining that gets done that some people may already know, but the filmmakers, I don't think they could bet on that being true.
Yeah, and it I think it ties into the show really well in the way that it sets that up, because in the Muppet Show, the TV show, all of the puppets are performers and they're putting on a show for you, the audience, and then you also see like scenes of them backstage, but they're also like in the canon of the narrative, also acting in certain scenes. And so it's this meta layer of it. And then this movie just takes it to the next degree where it's supposed to be they are sitting down and they've filmed the backstory of their show and like how the Muppet Show in how the show inside the show came to be. And so you're watching a movie of these fictional characters watching a movie of how they made the fictional show that is a real show. There's many layers to it, but you don't have to have seen the show to really get any of that. It just is like sort of an extra layer of reward. If you are a big fan of the Muppet Show, then it's an extra delight to like, oh, here's the in canon backstory to how this happened. But if you haven't seen the show, it's just like, all right, well, this is just a standalone story in itself.
Yeah, I think Hidson and Oz and that crew really enjoyed sort of playing with TV and film in that way to make things meta. The other thing that really stood out to me is I watched this movie last night with my three kids. They think it's hilarious, right? They're laughing all the way through it, but there's definitely jokes that are for the parents in the room. And I think about how, in our age, Pixar does such a good job of that, right? A Pixar movie, if it's a good one, should be funny for the kids and the adults watching. And the Muppets were good at that too. There's a lot in this movie that is funny to me as an adult that I didn't necessarily understand why it was funny when I was a kid. And I think that's even another layer on top of the story that's enjoyable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a big part of that was the number of celebrity cameos that they have in this movie. So the whole premise of the Muppet Show is that every episode they would have sort of a celebrity guest who was there and would do the show with the Muppets. And then the version of that sort of for the movie was that it's just chalk. Every character in this movie who's not a Muppet is like some famous comedian and performer who has one scene with the Muppets, and then they continue on their merry way onto the next scene. And I'm ashamed to say I only recognized one of these people on site, even though when I went back and read the list of names, I mean, it's Orson Welles and Mel Brooks and Richard Pryor and Bob Hope,
Bob
like
Hope, yeah.
really famous people. The only person I recognized on site was Steve Martin.
I mean, I recognized a couple of them, but you do get the sense, even if you're not sure who they all are now, because, you know, this movie is pretty old at this point. You're right. Anytime there's a human on screen, that human is famous. And
Yeah.
I think that really goes to how much respect Henson and Oz and the others had sort of in their circles. That, like, why would I be in a movie with a bunch of puppets, right? On the piece of paper, it seems silly, but they did it. And especially we're talking about his performance. I love Steve Martin's performance as the waiter, and I just feel like he is so close to breaking the whole time. I think he's just genuinely having fun, and there happens to be a movie crew there filming it. I like that is another meta layer that definitely would have spoken to people when it came out in 79.
Absolutely.
And it did. It was extremely successful.
Oh my gosh, yeah. That's so charming to me. So it was the seventh highest grossing film of the year. And it's to date is still the second highest grossing Muppet film, only after The Muppets in 2011. The point that you made earlier, where it's like the Muppets was a popular show, but not necessarily like enough to automatically translate to sort of a mainstream theatrical release movie. So the fact that they pulled that off is pretty impressive, and it of course allowed them to make lots of more movies.
Yeah, it really bankrolled the Jim Henson Productions for a long time. And if you look at the dates of the movies that we're going to cover, there's a lot in a pretty short time span. They really made a bunch of movies, and then it slowed down and has now had two kind of more in the modern era. But I'm sure it was also at the same time, like, you have the show, you have Sesame Street, you have all of these projects, and I'm sure taking on a movie felt like a really big step up. And I do wonder, like, for those involved, did it feel risky, or did they feel like, yeah, this is going to work. I just don't know. But the behind the scenes of the Muppet stuff is so interesting anyways. The original content they were doing with the Muppets wasn't for kids, right? It was very, very adult themed, and they adapted it and changed it over time, and they did a really good job with that. But it's just, I find Jim Henson and Frank Oz and all those original Muppet people, it's just a fascinating time to read about as far as creativity and art.
I feel like there are so few, this is going to sound like a really silly sentence, but there are so few puppets in the world that are taken seriously. And I think that the only reason, like, I think that the only sort of mainstream accepted puppetry is the Muppets and the Jim Henson Company and Sesame Street and like this whole sort of family. And that's just such a funny thing. It's like this really specific art form that they brought to be this pretty successful mainstream idea and is still like working with the Muppets or Sesame Street is like a big deal for a puppeteer, which I find very charming.
A big thing we'll talk about is the technical achievements in this movie. There are so many things we see the Muppets do in this that we see them do for the first time. Like, I mean, if you just asked a random person to close their eyes and picture a Muppet, you kind of view them from the waist up, right? And we know why that's true, because the way they have to be set up to, for the performer to move them, and there's a monitor so they can see them, and, you know, wires and all sorts of stuff. But some of the stuff they did in this film is just mind-blowing.
They really went for a lot of different effects with it. And I really appreciate that, especially because I think that they didn't have to. Like, I don't think anyone would have really been like, why didn't they do more effects with the puppets? But they said, well, we have a movie set and a bigger budget for this. So, like, let's see what we can actually do to expand sort of our puppet abilities with these Muppet characters. And now there's no going back. Now they have to keep just doing cool stuff because it's like, dear Lord, how'd you do that? But I was probably sort of like the two most prominent examples of this are Kermit singing in the pond with a full body shot of the puppet, which is, well, I mean, the kids wouldn't care, but I'm sure like adults going to see this movie for the first time and you've seen however many seasons of the Muppets and then suddenly like Kermit the Frog has a full body and he's singing a song to you in a swamp and you're like, whoa, this is different. And then of course Kermit riding a bicycle,
that's my favorite, and we'll get into some of how that worked out. I guess one last thing sort of on the meta level of this, this film is in the National Film Registry by the Library of Congress. It was added in 2009 for being culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant. Seems like a big honor. I don't have anything in the Library of Congress.
That's great.
Do you think they're saving podcasts in the Library of Congress?
Man, I genuinely wonder. I don't know. I hope so.
Oh, they have some podcasts, apparently. Okay, I'm going down the rabbit hole we don't have time for. Okay, Muppet movie.
Follow-up podcast. Which podcasts are in the Library of Congress?
Yeah. So let's talk about that opening scene, Kermit on the log in the water. I mean, it was probably 1991, probably I was 4 or 5 when I saw this movie for the first time. And as a little kid, I was kind of blown away that, oh, Kermit's like in the water. My kids watching last night, the older two who are 11 and 9, were like, wait, how does that work? Because they know that Kermit's a puppet, right? You know, so I got to explain to them how it worked, and it's just incredible. Like you said, the lengths they went to. They could have done this, and I think it still would have been an emotionally effective moment because the way that it opens is really cool. But the way they pulled the shot off just, to me, makes it such a more special thing.
Yeah, do you want to get into explaining like how this actually ended up working?
Yeah, so that is Kermit. He's on a log. He is surrounded by water. Henson, they designed and built this metal container for him, complete with an air hose, as you would imagine, and then a rubber sleeve that passed out of the container up to Kermit so he could control Kermit. And there was wiring and stuff, so he had a monitor in there to see his performance. And then he was under the water, under the log, to pull this off. So there's this great shot, and it's really just like they're just flexing in so many of these shots where you see Kermit and the camera pans and it's a clean pan to the reflection in the water. You're just like, where's the puppeteer? But here's the thing, Gwen. It took 5 days to film it.
He's so dedicated to his craft. I respect it deeply.
I mean, can you imagine like what your back would feel like after 5 days and what I assume is a tiny cramped metal container?
Oh, no. I love hearing the behind the scenes of movie stuff like this when you hear about like not only sort of the dedication to getting certain kinds of shots, but also the creativity required to even come up with these ideas is pretty amazing. And you can see, I think there are like pictures out there of what this looked like behind the scenes of how they had to like contort this situation to pull this off. But I think it ended up being totally worth it. Like, as this is a really iconic sort of image of not only this movie, but I think of Kermit overall as Kermit in the swamp playing and singing a Rainbow Connection, which is maybe the most wholesome opening to a movie ever.
Someday we'll find it, the Rainbow Connection, the lovers, the dreamers, and me.
I think you may be right. There's this great Vanity Fair article about this that we can have in the show notes, but it is extremely wholesome and it sets up. I mean, this song is still famous today, right? However many decades later, and I think one of the reasons for that is that while this is a technically impressive set of shots, it's not distractingly so. The reason we remember this is the performance and the song and the music. And the fact that it's like cool for us nerdy people is just bonus, I think. And I mean, we're watching it and like all three of my kids know all the words, right? And they've only seen this particular movie maybe twice, but they've seen the more recent ones several times and listened to the soundtracks and all that sort of thing. This song has really captivated generations of people. And I think it's all because of this excellent performance.
This excellent performance by a frog. But the most expressive puppet that ever lived. They did they re-released a new version of Rainbow Connection very recently, just a couple months ago, it's hashtag Disney Magic Moments, which I just noticed, which is kind of funny. But as just sort of a nice, sort of encouraging thing, they have just a high-res version of Kermit sitting in a swamp playing the banjo and doing this. It does not have the same kind of extreme technical shots on display, which I suspect they probably weren't willing to spend another 5 days doing this kind of thing for just this one-off internet video.
No, I was like, I don't want to get in that metal thing. It's 50 years old.
Waist up is fine for this one. Thank you.
Yeah. So do we want to get into the script or into the movie, and then we can talk about the other technical stuff as it comes up?
Yeah. So the whole sort of premise of this movie is we open with the characters in The Muppet Show sitting down to watch the movie that we're about to watch. As we mentioned earlier, there's a meta narrative to the whole thing. Then we have Kermit singing Rainbow Connection. And then Kermit runs into a Hollywood agent who's lost in the swamp, who may or may not be eaten by an alligator at the end of the scene. It's left kind of ambiguous. But he plants the seed in Kermit's head that he should go to Hollywood and audition to become a star. And the rest of the movie is Kermit traveling from an undisclosed location west to Hollywood and sort of picking up the rest of the Muppet gang on his way, scene by scene.
Yeah, it's like he's rolling downhill, just picking up momentum as it goes. That's kind of the way that I think about it. And, you know, and lifelong friends, as snowballs often do. I guess.
Concerned about your snowballs?
I live in Tennessee. I don't really know what they are. So he leaves Bernie with the alligator. Again, I guess Bernie lives? I don't know. The alligator looked kind of hungry. It was very upsetting. And we see Kermit riding his bike. And it's a really short little shot. And this is something that I want to follow as we watch more of these movies, because the bike riding gets way more complex. And I think even in the next movie, there's like a much bigger bicycle scene. And I've always wondered how they did this. And it looks practical. It doesn't look like it's done in post, especially thinking about how they could do things in the late 70s. But it turns out that Kermit was sort of attached to this bike and they used an overhead crane with strings. And so Kermit is kind of dangling from this, making contact with the ground. So, you know, the wheels turn and he's pedaling and his little froggy hands are on the handlebars. And it's just, it's, I love it so much. It's just so much fun to see a puppet ride a bicycle in such a convincing way. I mean, even as an adult, I still just love this little section of the movie.
I think it's worth noting that my notes here when I got to this scene just say, oh, to be a puppet frog riding a bicycle. It just really instills that feeling upon you of like, oh, just for this one moment, everything's okay. I'm just going to watch mm-hmm. Kermit ride this bicycle across the screen. And that's so sweet.
It's such an innocent, like he's just riding along, you know, he's being happy. And this is where we're introduced to who is going to be our protagonist. Antagonist. Frogtagonist.
First, the bike riding is interrupted by Kermit almost getting crushed to death by a steamroller.
Yeah, he has a great line after this.
Which I will say starts the whole theme of this movie of having way more threat violence than I remembered.
Yeah, there's a lot of guns later on and like a very upsetting German scientist. But he manages to escape the steamroller and he has this great line. If frogs couldn't hop, I'd be gone with the Schwinn. Well done. I think this is also the first time in this movie where a character directly addresses the camera. So like Kermit is looking at us when he says this. And this is a thing that happens on and off throughout these movies, but especially in this one, is that they will break that fourth wall and speak to the audience, which is themselves watching it in a movie theater and we're watching them. Again, it's meta. But it really, I think this is the first time we see it in this movie and it sort of jumps out at you at first.
Mm-hmm. It's Muppets all the way down.
It is.
And sort of the whole scene that Kermit has stumbled upon is the building of a frog legs restaurant, which is quite aggressive. There's a lot of questions raised in this movie that are not answered, which I think is the correct decision. But there's a... In the canon of the Muppets, we just take one moment diversion for this. So they're all puppets. That's not acknowledged at all. They are acknowledged as their sort of native animal. They are like referred to as frog, bear, pig, all that stuff. And it's not clear what, if any, distinction there is between the Muppets and the other animals, like animals that we would know in our worlds. Do they coexist? Is there a difference? Do humans see a difference between these two kinds of creatures? It's not really explained. And I don't think it should be explained necessarily, but it does leave something to think about.
I'm going to think about that all night long. That's going to keep me up.
Because if there is no distinction, then this frog legs restaurant is deeply concerning.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's kind of like on the Mickey Mouse side of things. You know, you had a dog that could like talk and walk, and then a dog that had a collar and, you know, walked on 4 feet. And
yeah,
I guess there's overlap because like the alligator is a seemingly very real alligator that wants to eat the guy from Hollywood.
Yeah.
I don't know. You're raising a lot of very troublesome questions, Quinn.
I really can't think about it for too long or I do become scared for their livelihoods.
Yeah. No, it gets very upsetting. And there's a line later that the Kermit says, like, all I can think of are frogs on tiny crutches. It's like, that is dark. What are we doing? This is a children's kind of movie.
Oh my God, poor Kermit.
Also, like, just okay. Have you ever eaten frog legs?
I don't think so.
I don't think I have either, but just thinking about them, like, it feels like you need a lot of frog legs to make a meal, right? Like, you think about like, the size of a frog. Like,
yeah.
How do you have a restaurant chain of these things? Like, are they that popular? What does the infrastructure look like here? These are things that you think about, you know, what happens to non-Muppet frogs. I think about, how do you run a frog, like, franchise?
And what are your margins like?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, clearly they're okay because you're being driven around in a limousine by a dude with a funny hat, but...
That's how I measure all markers of success. How many men with funny hats?
So we leave Kermit. He leaves his like smoking wreckage of a bike behind, I guess, and makes it to our next stop where he meets Fozzie the Bear at the El Slizo Cafe.
A very perfect, subtle addition to this movie.
It's very smoky inside. You can kind of smell it as you're watching it. A lot of brown and burgundy and, you know, beads hanging everywhere. It's very, very 1960s, 70s in there.
And it's there that, well, apparently the dancing girls are out. And so instead they have put on Fozzie Bear as a comedian, as the alternative entertainment.
How is a bear the backup to some dancing girls? Like, what's the, was he next in line? Was there something else? And he's like the third ringer? I'm very confused about how this works.
I think maybe there was some kind of stomach bug that really wiped out all the entertainment in the county.
Oh, yeah. I could see that. Maybe they all ate at the El Slizo Cafe. And so they, and Fozzie doesn't. So he's safe.
That makes sense to me. Or he's a bear and his stomach is made of sterner stuff.
Poor Fozzie. It's not going very well. But this is another section where we see the full body of the Muppet. And you and I both took notes that seeing the full Fozzie body is a little weird.
Yeah, for some reason, that's so much less okay than seeing Kermit's legs. I think partially because you've seen Kermit in the last couple of scenes where this is the first time you're seeing Fozzie, and one of the very few times that you see Fozzie in a full body shot. And this one actually has CG effects where they're like using a green screen to make them, because they had to film them dancing, and so there's a lot going on, and they actually have the background like green screen behind them, and so it does just look off generally, mm-hmm. in sort of addition to the strangeness of seeing a puppet full body shot that you've never seen before. So it did not come off as well as the earlier scenes with Kermit.
I agree. But, you know, it's going downhill. The piano player is trying to keep things going. Kermit tries to keep things going. And Fozzie's just not, he's just not good at this at this point. And the crowd riots. I love the little gag. We haven't talked about this yet. This movie is so dense with jokes. Like every 3 seconds, there's a joke in this movie, it feels like.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite gags is they throw them off the stage, and like Kermit, you know, that they get caught up in the fan. Kermit ends up crashing into the upright piano, but Fozzie kind of body slams the bartender, and like 2 seconds later he pops up wearing a beard and the bartender's clothing. It's like, oh, drinks are on the house, and, you know, tricks everybody to go outside. But like, you, no one could change clothes that quickly, but it's such a funny moment to see that he is so quick on his feet, his very awkward feet, to come up with this as a plan to get out of it.
Yeah. He sells them drinks around the house, and it cuts to everyone in the bar is now on the roof, and mm-hmm. they're going, there are no drinks up here.
Yeah. They got a good laugh from the 5-year-old in the audience that I was in.
There's a lot of wordplay and puns in this movie, as well as meta humor, mm-hmm. kind of things they come back to over and over again. And then, of course, like the physical comedy bits, you know, Fozzie popping up with the bartender's clothes on.
There's also a recurring gag, although I think it only happens 2 or 3 times, between the way Kermit sounds Miss and Myth, and a woman named Myth always like answers like out from behind something. And, you know, Kermit, I think he says, oh, great, it's a running gag. It's like, yeah, I don't know why that's in the movie, but it's kind of funny that it keeps happening. And again, of course, that woman was a huge star at the time, so that was part of it, cramming more cameos into it, I guess. But I don't know. It seems to have aged a little weird for me.
Yeah, there are a couple of things that are definitely sort of their time, or just like have lost their humor as time has gone on. They also have this running gag that I don't get at all. They do this like 3 or 4 times, or it's Hare Krishna.
Oh, yeah. I did it. I looked into this.
What is this?
So it is, according to the internet, which is never wrong, a mantra often used in Indian meditation. And it was this big movement in the 60s and 70s when this was being shot.
Okay.
These folks were the people who would be like in long robes and be at places like airports or, you know, city centers handing out flowers and books and things. And so the joke is, oh, do you feel lost? Maybe you should try this Eastern meditation religion thing. And so that's kind of where that comes from. And it's all over this movie. There's even a shot of the church where we're going to meet Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem. And it's like on the church sign. So it's definitely of its moment when this movie was being made.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's another one that would probably have been really funny to the adults watching this at the time.
Yeah.
But it's just out of the zeitgeist now. And I'm like, I don't really know what this means at all.
Yeah, I had to go out on some homework for that because I kind of felt the same way.
They make it out of El Slizo. And now Fozzie has a car.
I think there's a little thing in here, too, that may hint to your what's a Muppet and what's an animal. So Fozzie can drive. We learn later that he learned through the mail, which is hilarious. But it's his uncle's car, and his uncle is hibernating. So Fozzie's not hibernating. So it's like his uncle, like a wild bear, not a Muppet bear. I don't know. It's like a little crack to see into that world, maybe.
Well, now I want to know, if he is a wild non-Muppet bear, how'd he get a car?
That's true.
There are layers here.
Yes, so Fozzie has a car. They get in the car. Turns out that Doc Hopper, the man who owns the Frog Leg restaurants, and Max, his assistant or driver, they are there. You know, Max spotted Kermit riding the bike. It was his idea. Like, you know, Doc Hopper's been looking for a spokesperson. This is kind of sets up their relationship that Doc Hopper wants a spokesperson for his restaurant. He's shot this really bad commercial that he shows Kermit where he's in like the frog suit and trying to sing and dance. But he says, you know, Kermit, you're so talented. You should be the spokesperson for my restaurant. And Max is really proud that, you know, he found this frog and he thinks it's going to work out. And so this sets off this relationship where effectively Doc Hopper and Max are stalking Kermit and Fozzie and friends across the country trying to at first ask nicely if Kermit will do this, and he ramps up the heat and then becomes violent at the end of the movie.
Yeah, to the point where they actively try to assassinate Kermit.
Yeah.
Which, again, this movie is for children. It gets real close there, but at the beginning, it's all fun and games.
Yeah. Kermit doesn't want this job, right? He makes fun of Doc Hopper's performance. And something else that stood out at me, Kermit is not afraid to like say something sort of ugly to somebody. He's like, well, you're a terrible frog, you know, and it jumps out at you thinking of it as a purely a kid's movie that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily expect to see that. But Kermit tells the truth and he says, hey, I'm not interested. And they take off and we come to my second favorite song in this movie. Moving Right Along.
Moving right along in search of good times and good news.
It's such a bop. This song is great. When this song started, because I had forgotten this song completely. I remembered Rainbow Connection, but this one started and I was like, this is great. I might just add this to some playlists right now.
Yeah. Oh, it is good. And again, it's full of jokes. So there's all these little twists and turns in the lyrics where he says, you know, you're going to come to a fork in the road and we see it. He, you know, he's talking about haven't seen the sun come up in the west. Help us. You know, we're in Saskatchewan and they drive by like a Canadian ranger on a horse. it is really dense as far as the humor and it's just a killer song.
The bit with the fork in the road is there's literally a giant fork
in
the road. And that's one of the very few things that I have, for some reason, has specifically stuck with me since the first time I saw this movie at like age six or whatever. I've always remembered that fork in the road. To my six-year-old brain, that was the peak joke.
Mm-hmm. It's really good. I mean, the fork is enormous.
Yes.
I do have another technical note here about the car and how Fozzie can drive a Studebaker that he borrowed from his uncle who may or may not be hibernating and may or may not be an actual bear. Obviously, Fozzie can't drive. Like the way that these Muppets were controlled, they didn't have sight out of the, you know, the eyes or anything. And so there was a second steering wheel and monitor and controls wired up and placed in the trunk of the car. So someone was in the trunk of the car driving. They used cameras hidden in the front of the car so they could see where they were going. And then the puppeteers for Kermit and Fozzie were kind of behind the front seat, crouched down, like controlling them. So this car was hacked all to pieces inside to make it work. But again, just like the ingenuity that went into this and sort of the, I don't want to say bravery, but kind of like you got to drive this from the trunk based on like a view of a camera, like bold choice, but it works. And the humor of seeing Fozzie Bear drive a car will just never get old to me. It's just so funny. And that's how they pulled it off. Some person stuck in, again, curled up in a tiny metal place, making things happen.
Especially considering how many movies are perhaps over-reliant on CGI these days, the extent to which this movie was dedicated to practical effects wherever it could is really great.
Oh, yeah. I mean, some of the stuff I would imagine would have looked pretty bad with what they could do at the time. Like that Fozzie green screen, like, just looks off. So, but yeah, they made it work, right? The story was having them be on this road trip, so they made the road trip work. And I have a lot of respect for that.
A great sort of in-joke meta bit that comes across at this part as well is they run into Big Bird on the road.
Yes.
And they ask, they were like, do you want to hitch a ride with us or going to Hollywood? And he says, no, I'm headed to New York to try to break into public television.
So I also have a note about this. This helps, I think, place this movie in time. So on the meta level, they've been doing the Muppet Show for several years. They take time off. They do this movie. But Sesame Street premiered on public television in November of 1969. So I think this movie has to happen sometime before that. So sometime in the mid to late 60s, because Big Bird would be on his trip to New York.
Interesting.
I can't prove that, but if the Sesame Street timeline in real life syncs in with this movie, the contents of this movie are taking place at least 10 years or 11 years before the movie came out.
Oh, that's fascinating. I feel like that sounds about right, because that even in sort of the canon of the Muppets, this movie is supposed to take place. The events of this movie take place before the show and all of that. So that would make a lot of sense.
But yeah, it was great seeing Big Bird. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. good inclusion.
We now come to my favorite song in this movie.
I focus on the pleasure, something I can treasure. Can you picture that?
I love, absolutely love Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem. They could be one of my favorite bands. But this song, Can You Picture That, I love it. I love it so much.
It's so much fun. This is also the point. So they find them in a church. Dr. Teeth and Electric Mayhem are performing in an old church or practicing in an old church. And they have the most in-depth meta joke of the whole movie, where instead of explaining how they got to that point, they were like, oh, that'll take too long. The audience will get bored. Here, just read the script. And they hand over a copy of the script of the movie they're performing to Dr. Teeth so that he can read it and get caught up on everything that's happened so far.
It raises a lot of questions about how time works.
It is a bit of a recursive loop.
Yeah, because later that this becomes how they're saved, is that Dr. Teeth had the script to the movie that he's living. Dr. Teeth is living it in real time. We're watching it. But Kermit and Fozzie already know how it ends because they're characters in the movie. Whew, my head hurts. Yeah, so they leave the church. The band, during this amazing song, has painted their car multicolored. It looks bananas. They're, of course, immediately spotted again by Doc Copper, but then they hide in front of a multicolored billboard. Everything just happens to line up, which is another great gag. And they're driving along, and they run into our friend Gonzo, who's not a very good driver. Also, part of his car is made of plywood, which is concerning.
That can't be safe.
No, not at all. He's got chickens in there? I have a lot of questions about Gonzo's life at this point.
I think Gonzo has a lot of questions about his life.
That's true. He has a very reflective moment coming up that's kind of heartbreaking in a way.
Yeah.
Poor Gonzo. Yeah, they run into Gonzo. He has crossed the double yellow line, and they're going to have a head-on collision. But instead, because it's the Muppets, Gonzo's plumbing truck is upside down on top of the car. And Gonzo, like, pops down from the windshield. And he does this twice. He does this later, like, the exact same move, which is another reference. And he comes in the car, and he's, quote, hopping mad. So he's, like, hopping up and down, which is... That's a kid joke. I think it's in there for the kids. Like, oh, because I'm hopping mad, you know. But yeah, we meet Gonzo, the whatever he is.
The who knows. He's got a chicken with him.
He does.
Who does not speak English.
Mm-mm.
More questions. It's just chicken, but also she's sentient, and Gonzo can understand her, but we can't because she's speaking chicken language. We're not going to get into that. but they, and then they, this might be my favorite non-musical scene in the movie is when they pull up to a used car lot to see if they can trade in their two busted cars for one bigger functional car. And they have a whole interaction with the used car salesman, who of course does not want to give them like any real trade-in value, and there's this back and forth. And then he calls for Jack and Sweetum, who's the giant mup, who's a full-size man in a costume, rolls up, and they're like, oh, hi, Jack, nice to meet you. And he goes, Jack, not name, Jack Job.
It is really good.
I think that's my favorite joke in the movie. And he proceeds to jack up the car by lifting it up. And Sweetums, I love you.
This guy's whole thing is you pay what's on the sticker, right? We've all heard of these places or been to them. And he's going to give them... what is it, like $12 for their trade-in?
Yeah.
And all the cars are like $2,000, right? There's one, it's this, best I can tell, like 30s or 40s Ford wagon. It's got the, you know, the wood down the sides. Kind of cool looking, in my opinion. And Jack is standing there, and there's a bug flying around, and he hits the bug and kills it. And the bug guts make it look like it's $11.95. And... this car lot guy apparently is a man of his word and gives them the car and a nickel in change because they had $12 worth of car to trade in, and they're off again in their new, much larger car to accommodate the people, the guests they're going to be having down the road.
I do respect that he's a man of his word. You know, what's on the sticker is what you pay.
That's right. I hope he didn't dock Jack's pay. That'd be not, that would be cool.
But they... are rolling right along, the ever-present threat of frog murder behind them for now. And they stumble across what seems to be just like a very standard run-of-the-mill state fair somewhere out there in like Iowa or something.
Yeah, it's definitely the Midwest somewhere. I mean, it's like everyone's in flannel, there's a hayride, and there's a beauty contest.
And as a surprise to no one who's seen the Muppet Show... who do they meet here but Miss Piggy winning a beauty contest.
Mm-hmm. Go Miss Piggy. Way to go. They have this love at first sight thing going on between Kermit and Miss Piggy, and she breaks into this very romantic, including like very romantic B-roll of Kermit and Piggy like running through a field, and there's sort of some winking and nudging about what may be going on in the field.
Yeah.
It's quite a scene.
Never before have two souls joined so freely.
There's also a scene in her imagination where they get married and sort of ride off into the sunset. Yeah. And I realized that's the joke that started this podcast. Is a while back on Twitter, I asked what musicals have weddings in them, and you replied the Muppet Movie.
Yeah.
And that's why we're here today.
Yep. And I mean, the Muppets Take Manhattan, which we'll get to in a few months, that's a core aspect of that movie. So,
yep.
hey, you know, Kermit and Piggy, they're in love. Maybe one of them more in love than the other, as we see. But
yeah, it's funny how the scene sets it up, because they start out where Kermit is clearly entranced by this mysterious pig, and wants to watch her do her speech. And then she lays eyes on him and is just like, fully head over heels, and he's like, oh god, okay.
Yeah. She like comes down to the crowd at some point, and they're like holding each other as the song fades, and they kind of like come out of a daze, I guess, and it's sort of awkward, I think, between them. And Kermit's like, hey, you know, we're gonna get ice cream. He tells her about Hollywood, and of course Miss Piggy misunderstands, thinking that he has invited her to Hollywood with them. In reality, he just invited her to ice cream with them. And he corrects her during this. Is another time where Kermit's kind of sharp with another character. He's like, no, like I wasn't inviting you to Hollywood with us. Like, don't be ridiculous. I just said, do you want to come get some ice cream, which happens to be served by Bob Hope. So Fozzie Bear gets to meet Bob Hope while all this is going on with Kermit.
Yeah. Which I will say is pretty harsh for Kermit, considering he's invited literally every random sentient being he's come across so far to come with them to Hollywood.
Yeah.
And now he's suddenly like, oh, we were just going to go for ice cream.
Yeah. Even Jack, you know, he spends the rest of the movie chasing them down. But Gonzo, who he had a car crash with, like all of these people are just swept up in his dream. And yeah, it stands out that he doesn't extend that to Miss Piggy, but they end up kind of putting this on hold because Gonzo has an up moment and gets pulled away in a bunch of balloons. I mean, who hasn't had that happen to them?
Who hasn't been a child and tried to make that happen to them?
That's true. So he gets pulled away in the wind, and they're chasing him. Doc Hopper's chasing them. Their new car doesn't do anything to throw Doc Hopper. And they end up having this, like, another car accident where Doc Hopper and Max crash into yet another billboard. There's so many billboards in this movie. There's, like, every stop, there's a billboard involved in the screenplay. But they crash into it, and it has some giant pie on it. And then Max eats it. Like, did you have real pie in a billboard? Like, do you have to change that out every couple of days? Like, what if it gets hot? I have a lot of questions about this billboard technology.
I wouldn't think too much about that billboard. Yeah, this is where things start getting more egregiously violent on behalf of Doc Hopper, by the way, where they're actually shooting at them now.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they escape without any harm done, partially because they're puppets, so it'd be pretty hard to hurt them.
Yeah, he ends up shooting Gonzo out of the sky accidentally, and that's how Gonzo lands on the car again. Yeah, they make it away again. And like, how small is the U.S. that Doc Hopper can just stay behind them the whole time? I have a lot of questions. That's just the answer. That's just like the recurring theme of this movie, I guess. But they get away again, and Piggy's with them just because she got swept up in the excitement of, oh, we have to go chase down Gonzo. And they go out for a date at this restaurant with a very familiar Steve Martin as their waiter.
Yeah. A very bad waiter.
He is.
He's very rude to them. He's also wearing shorts, which I found quite funny. He's wearing like a suit and tie on top and shorts.
Very short shorts. My wife pointed that out, how funny he looked in that outfit.
He seemed like he was having a lot of fun.
He also serves them, I don't know if you caught this, he serves them wine from Idaho.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Idaho's known for an export. It's not wine. It's potatoes.
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to be good. And turns out it's not very good.
No, I like the bit where, so he's serving them the wine, it's terrible, and then they ask for straws, and he was like, yes, I thought you might need straws, and puts straws in their wine glasses, which is so funny, because of course, like, they're puppets, how are they supposed to drink it without straws?
Right.
How are they supposed to drink it with straws, really? But just the little nod to, the humans can tell that they are not normal creatures, they know that they need straws, I don't know.
He's prepared. You know, maybe he's not a bad waiter after all.
Maybe it's one of those restaurants where the deal is that they're mean to you and it's part of the appeal, but they like otherwise have good service. It's kind of unclear.
Have you ever been in a situation where you're out somewhere and you realize you're in over your head socially? Like, this is too fancy of a place for me.
Yes.
Maybe that's what Kermit has going on. Because like Piggy kind of pokes him like, oh, you're supposed to ask this. You're supposed to do this. Kermit, I don't think has spent much time as a frog who had a banjo in a swamp just 2 days ago. Hasn't been in really fancy restaurants before. So maybe, you know, maybe this interaction is partially on Kermit. That's all I'm saying.
That's true. Maybe set off the waiter in the wrong way.
Yeah.
But Miss Piggy and Kermit are having a nice date, and they have their first kiss. it's very weird, the inclusion of Puppet Romance, but they do have like a very beautiful romantic moment until it is interrupted by a phone call.
Uh-huh.
And then in the most weirdly aggressive scene in this movie, it seems like Miss Piggy has left Kermit.
Yeah, just ghosted him. Just left. Just walked out.
Walks out in the middle of the date. He's really sad about it. He goes over to the pianist, who is Ralph the dog.
Mm-hmm.
and they both, then they sing a duet about how they wish they're, about how they've been unlucky in love. And it's a whole very much like can't live with him, can't live without him kind of thing about women and dating.
We grin and bear it because the nights are long. I hope that something better comes along.
Which I just find very funny that, like, Kermit has watched Miss Piggy over the last 24 hours show nothing but incredibly pointed and clear interest in him.
Mm-hmm.
And then she disappears at the same time that they're is an actual murderer tracking them down, and his only thought is, well, she left me.
Yeah.
He never once thinks maybe something happened to her.
Do you think he felt bad if he realized that later?
I kind of hope he felt bad. The song is like pretty aggressive when you take into consideration that she did actually just get kidnapped.
Mm-hmm. There's this great little line in here from Ralph about how he talks about his day. And he says that he takes himself for a walk before bed because
yeah.
Ralph's a dog. Cracks me up. Like, you don't, you're alive. Like, you can play piano, but you don't have a bathroom inside. Like,
honestly, that's what my life is kind of like right now. I mean, like, I do my work and then I make myself dinner. I go for a little walk around the block and then I go back to sleep.
Yeah, but you're not going outside for like restroom purposes, are you?
No.
I was just checking.
Haven't reached that point of the quarantine yet. I still remember how most parts of life work.
But yeah, this song is pointed, and this goes on, and then Kermit gets a phone call at the end of the song, and it's Hopper saying that he has Miss Piggy. So he goes out of the restaurant, and he is held up at gunpoint by like 12 dudes. It's so many guns.
It's so many guns.
They're all like shotguns. Like, you just see the it's not great. Kermit's having a bad day here. And we get to what I think is the scariest part of this movie. At least I remember it being scary as a kid, of this German professor and this machine that's going to melt Kermit's brain just enough where he'll do what Doc Hopper wants, but he can still sing and dance, which, like, I'm not a scientist, but that seems like a very thin margin to hit in a brain melting machine. it's creepy.
It's deeply creepy. Sort of the same basic premise of like, oh, we're going to destroy your mind to use you for our own ends is used in like other forms of media in like deeply serious and horrifying situations. And then also here in the Muppet movie, I guess they kind of got away with it because I think that they're tonally, I think that people watching understand that they're always going to make it out. And there's, you know, we understand that there's that they're not going to actually kill Kermit or melt his brain. But it still is quite a lot for a children's movie, especially the scene.
Yeah. And I don't like the professor. Like, he uses a German accent and he says some things that are pretty racist at times, like kind of uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It's not great. This character would not fly today.
Yeah, it is pretty uncomfortable. I don't think it's really necessary either. I think that we get that Kermit is in danger without this like whole scene happening, and it's pretty gross.
But the power of love cannot be contained, and as Kermit is being strapped into this, Piggy breaks free. Her eyes go crazy, like she has these huge angry eyes. And she, like, beats up all the goons with all their guns. And during this fight, frees Kermit. And then the professor ends up cooking his own brain. Which I guess is a real danger if you own a brain cooking machine. You got to be careful not to fall into it yourself.
It's very, like, a this way up kind of situation. Got to make sure you're keeping track of that.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I've forgotten that one of the aspects of Miss Piggy's character is that she's a martial artist.
Yeah.
So it's kind of fun that they included that here. And then I think, and then she just kind of looks at Kermit and she's like, well, okay. when she saves every when she saves both of them by just decimating this group of people and then walking away.
Yeah, yeah, she is off to do a commercial. She gets another phone call, which, like, how do people calling them know where they are? I guess, I don't know. This movie would be easier to manage in a world of iPhones, but she gets a call. There's a commercial she's going to do. So she just leaves, right? The last couple of days just gone because she has a job opportunity that's real, not the dream of a job out in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. I kind of respect it, honestly. I'm like, yeah, this has been a pretty weird couple of days for you. You need to take a break.
It's got to get right. Got to get back on that horse, you know?
So at this point, you know, they're free. Miss Piggy's off to do her commercial. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the point in which they pull us back into the meta narrative as well.
Yeah.
Like, there's literally sort of I don't even know what the word for this is, but something happens with the film that they're watching.
Yeah, it like the movie theater itself like has some sort of problem. And so we get to peer into, I guess, just as a reminder that this is happening. Like, we're watching the movie as they watch the movie. I think it's pretty effective.
Yeah, it gives them the chance to have a couple snappy lines about it. You have Statler and Waldorf heckling the movie a little bit. Just gives you a little chance to... I think this is partially also just to give some of those characters that aren't in the main narrative of the movie a couple of lines, remind you that they're there.
Yeah.
And then they fix the film and get back into it.
Yeah, and when we get back to it, we have the... what Kermit calls the patriotic part of the movie.
Yeah.
Which I guess is it serves as a time lapse, like move their road trip along. I guess that's what they're going for. But Fozzie's singing America, and there's all these beautiful shots of, you know, the Midwest and the West, and they're driving, and everyone is just so happy that this is all going on.
I feel like this has to be some sort of joke about, like, road trip movies or something, or like movies of the era that like supposedly had a patriotic part, or I'm not sure. I feel like this has to be kind of parodying a specific thing, but I don't know what it is.
Yeah, I had that thought too. There's a little line too that when Kermit says that to his nephew, it's like, oh, should we stand? And Kermit's like, no, like we don't have to stand. And that jumped out at me, like that feels like a commentary on something, but I'm too young to maybe know what it is.
It's a very interesting inclusion. And yeah, there's probably a lot more like political humor going on in this scene that I am able to grasp in 2020 because the zeitgeist has shifted. But I don't know.
So I guess Hopper is pretty mad that Kermit escaped the German brain machine.
He's hopping mad.
Good. And he brings in Snake Walker. You know what his job is?
He kills frogs.
Kill frogs.
Sure.
That's a job. He's dressed in all black, so you know he's a bad guy. And he has a pitchfork shooting gun. There's a name for this that is escaping me, but it is terrifying.
Yeah, this dude is, I guess maybe frogs are like a much more prevalent and... a big ubiquitous thing in this universe, if they're like whole restaurant chains supported by frogs and they're people whose entire job is to kill frogs, I guess. But yeah, this is the new thing, specific frog assassin that's heading out after these people. They once again do not succeed at murdering Kermit.
Mm-mm.
Yet.
Not yet.
But the car that they're driving does break down in the middle of the desert.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not ideal. Again, a plot point that's been used for much more serious and dismal films, but here is just, you know, a little stop in the road trip.
Yeah, a little stop on the road trip. They've come across Miss Piggy since then, and she tries to make up, and Kermit's not having it, and they break down. They build this campfire. And this is where we have Gonzo's song, I'm Going to Go Back There Someday.
And yet so far away, I'm going to go back there someday.
Speaking about, I guess, his time in the sky with the balloons where he felt, you know, he felt free. He felt something that he hadn't felt before. It's really sweet and it's kind of tragic if you think about this guy who... was a plumber and he's in love with a chicken and he wants to go to India to become a movie star. And like, Yeah, he got a taste of what his life could be, and now he's broken down in the desert with some strangers, and maybe he's lamenting that a little bit.
Yeah, it's a really sweet song, and I think that tonally it fits very well in this part of the movie, and they're all sort of trying to figure out what's going to happen next, because they're really stuck at this point. But lyrically, this song is very specifically about Gonzo and his experiences, which I found interesting. It actually has nothing to do with the rest of them, but they are, you know, listening and empathizing with him. But yeah, this will be a theme that is revisited in later Muppet movies to varying levels of success. Mm-hmm. But and then Kermit starts fully hallucinating himself and having a conversation with himself in the desert. So I'm not sure how well he's doing mentally.
You've never wandered in the desert to talk to yourself? I thought that was, I mean, Burning Man's basically built off this idea in the movie.
That's true, I guess. I guess they, like, he just got the cheap version of that experience.
Yeah, it's the turning point, though. This is the lowest part of the movie for the gang. They think they're never going to make it. You know, Kermit is worried that he's promised something that he can't deliver, and he comes out of the desert with this sense of, you know, I'm doing this for me. I promised myself that I would do this. And he kind of has this reborn energy to chase after his dream. And as he comes back, their hero, Dr. Teeth, has found them because he read ahead in the script. Because how does time work?
Yeah, I wonder, did they sort of plan this from the beginning? When they're writing this movie, did they plan this as the beginning as like a fun tie around follow-up to them handing over the script? Or did they really write themselves in a corner and were like, we're going to need to put something in this movie to make this work so we can save these puppets we've stranded in the desert?
Yeah, Dr. Teeth has this great line. It says, "Exterior desert night. We knew right where to find you."
Yes.
Oh, it's so good. I love the band. They're playing sort of a remix of a song we heard earlier, but sort of more tonally correct for the movie, like you said, for this point of the movie. It's just great to see these folks, and they're here to rescue them. They're here to take them the rest of the way because they have a van, and having a van means you're cool.
It absolutely does. At this point, they're sort of heading up. They've achieved sort of the personal catharsis moment of the movie in terms of character arcs, but they still have the existential threat of frog assassins after them. And Max at this point catches up to them by impersonating a police officer, mm-hmm. which is interesting. But and he just uses that moment to warn Kermit that, you know, the frog assassins are after him. And Kermit decides that he must face them in a showdown.
Yeah, so there's this ghost town. We're gonna inject a little Wild West into the movie at this point.
Sure, why not? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they literally roll into this ghost town, which they think is totally abandoned. And I guess they're gonna try to set up for some kind of showdown. And then they run into Dr. Bunsen Honeydew, and his much beleaguered lab assistant Beaker.
I love Beaker.
He's so cute.
Yeah, it's a joke in our house that if someone says temporary, then the other person has to say like standard temporary, like Beaker does. it's a joke in our household for a long time. But yeah, they've set up shop in this ghost town to hide out to make their inventions with some privacy. They have all sorts of wild things, including these pills that make you really big, which is going to come back. In a moment, you know, Honeydew and Beaker, they have, let's say, a wide-ranging scale of success with their science projects throughout the movie. Some things work, some things don't. Some things are important, some things aren't. But I love it that they just stumbled across these two, again, Muppets, not humans, that are just like hanging out in this town. That how do they power? How do they eat? I mean, when the van rolled in, a horse skeleton fell down. Like, this place is abandoned. But here they are making science happen.
They live on science alone.
Oh, yeah. Maybe they're making like some sort of food pellets or something back there.
Maybe the puppets don't need to eat. I don't know.
Then why go to a restaurant for a date?
Where else are you supposed to go on a date?
That's true.
They've learned our human ways.
So Hopper is here. Snake Walker, Gill Frogs, he's here. And we both wrote this down, I think both in capital letters, Kermit's cowboy boots.
Kermit's cowboy boots. Kermit rolls out to meet him in these little frog cowboy boots and a little frog cowboy hat, and it's perfect.
That's so adorable.
I now want a Kermit doll with the boots. I just want to have one and just put it on my desk so I can just look at it and smile every day, because it's one of the cutest things I've ever seen.
I bet that's out there somewhere.
I'm sure it is. These characters have been fully merchandised.
Oh, yeah. And Kermit makes this speech to Hopper and his thugs that, you know, I think you're a good person at heart, and I don't think you want to kill me. I think this has just gotten out of control, and, you know, I think you are willing to let us go. But if not, then you should go ahead and kill me, because this isn't going to go any further. And I think to everyone's surprise watching the movie, Hopper's like, you know what? You're right. Time to die.
It's so intense. Kermit reached out with the power of friendship, and this dude chose to kill him. Well, he tries to. Obviously, he does not succeed in killing Kermit, but oh my God.
It's really upsetting.
I kind of respect that choice, though, of like just really throw in a twist right at the end there that the audience wouldn't expect.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure people watching this were like, wait, what? Because it's very Muppety for friendship to be the thing that ends this terrible trial in their lives, right? It's what you would expect from a movie like this. And, you know, Hopper does think it over. He takes his hat off. He kind of runs his fingers through his hair. And is like, you know what? You're wrong about me. We gotta do this. And at this point, I guess Snake Walker, Kill Frogs guy is just like, he's like, it's his moment, right? He's ready to go. But turns out that science and Animal are here to save the day.
I love Animal so much. We haven't talked about him at all, but I just have to say that he's one of my favorite Muppets. I think he should be freed and allowed to wreck whatever mayhem he wants to.
Mm-hmm.
He's the drummer in Electric Mayhem and is, you know, an animal, and he just wants to smash stuff, and I respect him for it. But he takes one of those growth pills that we saw a couple scenes earlier, and like Ant-Man, rises through, grows so large that he rises through the ceiling of the building that he's in, and it scares away all of Hopper and his guys.
Can you imagine being a hired gun, or even Doc Hopper or the snake killer, and this enormous Muppet, who Animal looks crazy at regular size, right? He's got hair everywhere. He has this huge, like, collar and chain deal going on because he wants to eat everything, so they have to keep him under control. And he rises out of this building, and he just screams, and everything shakes, right? Everything is, like, moving around, and they're falling into the dust. It'd be terrifying.
Every single character in this movie would be dead if it wasn't for the Electric Mayhem. They saved them multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, here Animal saves them all just through being so big that he scares everyone off.
Oh, that's so good. And it's a pretty good effect, too. Like, you see it from behind, and there's boards and stuff in his hair, like in his dreadlocks. I like the way this looks. I think they do a pretty good job of it.
Yeah, I do think it was a pretty good effect. And Animal is just such a great character design, mm-hmm. even normal size, and I think it really works as his giant self as well.
So they make it. Animal saves them. Doc Hopper and crew run away. Max is happy. Max is kind of cheering this on. So I feel like Max, you know, he turned between this and warning Kermit. So that's a good way to go. I mean, Max is what started all this, because he's the one who discovered Kermit and told Hopper about it. And so Max kind of redeems himself, I think, here at the end of the movie, which is nice.
Yeah.
And they make it. They make it to Hollywood.
I'm assuming they just walk into the building labeled Hollywood. I don't really know how they get there, but the whole group of Muppets, everyone they've accumulated so far, pours into the office of this big shot Hollywood producer, and his receptionist, who's played by Cloris Leachman, doesn't want to let them in because of of course she doesn't. They're a group of animals who are being very loud in her lobby. But she's allergic to animals. And mm-hmm. so they effectively poison her to overpower her. Yeah. They'll start shaking their fur so that she'll have a sneezing fit. This poor woman.
Yeah. Yeah. She's like on the ground. And like as her last movement, she like buzzes them in. Yeah. I feel bad for her.
I hope she's okay.
I hope she got, you know, some sort of allergy shot or something after this.
But they go in to confront this big shot Hollywood producer, director, whatever he is. And it's Orson Welles, mm-hmm. of course. And Kermit has a little speech about how he's come so far and wants to be given a proper chance, not like those Hollywood frogs. Again, apparently a lot of frogs exist in this universe.
Yes.
And he needs the chance to make it big in Hollywood. And I was expecting to be there some kind of callback to like the card he got from the agent in the first scene or something. But there isn't actually any of that. Orson Welles just looks at him and thinks about it and then is like, all right.
He calls for the standard rich and famous contracts for Kermit and his friends.
I'd take it. I would take the rich and famous contract. Sure.
Yeah. I don't think it's that easy, but maybe it is. You know, maybe that's the secret of Hollywood. It's actually way easier than we all think it is. And so we stay away.
I like to imagine that in his mind, you know, he's just had a really long day and these animals, puppets roll in and he looks at him and he goes, you know what? I've got more money than God. This could be fun. Sure. Why not?
Yeah. Let's just do it. Let's just see what's the worst that could happen. We then cut for the final scene to Kermit and the crew. They're on a soundstage and they're building another meta level. They are building the set pieces for the movie that we just saw. They're getting ready to shoot it. So
yeah,
it has looped all the way back around now. And it's, you know, it's different. It's sort of cartoony in a way, you know, it's not the real Oslizo Cafe. It's painted on a backdrop, but we see them beginning to do this, and we have all these little scenes of Muppets doing things. So, you know, Muppets are setting lights up. Crazy Harry is like doing things with electricity. And you and I both enjoyed, I think, the sound check that Animal does.
Oh my God. Yeah. Where they're doing sound, and he goes, I forget exactly what the prompt is, but just like need to check the levels. And Animal just screams, "Testing!"
Yeah.
Sound is ready. Give me a level.
Testing!
It just really tickled me.
Uh-huh. And Honeydew's, like, the headphones are vibrating and his ears are smoking.
You know, I have clients who do testing like that sometimes, but...
Do they? Just really loud?
Yeah.
Well, you gotta know where the peak is, you know?
It's true. You know, that's useful sometimes.
Yeah. And they get starting. They get started. It's going well. Kermit's walking around. And then Gonzo comes in, and Gonzo's a little clumsy at times. We're going to see this in later movies. Gonzo is sort of accident prone, and he ends up basically destroying the entire set and blowing. This ends with a lights exploding and blowing a hole in the ceiling.
Yeah.
It's like this. It really progressed quickly to him kind of being blown around on balloons out of control. Like he knocks into some things and then things are exploding and like, it really comes apart quickly for Gonzo.
But it's all okay because the heavens are on the side of the Muppets. So they bust this hole in the ceiling, but then a rainbow comes pouring in to light their scene and to add a beautiful rainbow hue to everyone.
Oh, it's so nice.
And this also leads into one of the coolest shots of the movie right at the end here is there's this giant rainbow pouring in and there are hundreds of Muppets dancing and singing this song.
Way more than we've seen in the whole movie. Like even Big Bird's yeah. back there. It's basically all the Muppets. And it's really cool.
I was reading a little bit about the background of this, and it's basically every single Muppet character that's ever been on screen is they pulled in for this. And they said that they had to call in like every puppeteer. I forget the exact phrase. It was almost every puppeteer west of the Rockies reported for pit duty. There are 250 puppets in it. And it's 150 puppeteers in a 6-foot deep pit that they have just filled with people and puppets to pull off this last shot where every single puppet is in motion and performing along to this song.
Yeah, it's really spectacular. It's this nice tag for the movie. It wraps around at the beginning with Rainbow Connection. It's a really sweet way to end the movie because this group of friends have found victory and they've only found it because of each other. And it's just a solid message. And it's a perfect ending for this.
They spend the song like looking directly to camera and encouraging the viewer to follow their dreams, which actually made me kind of emotional. It's really lovely way to end it and to have this sort of direct encouragement to everyone watching, but especially for the kids watching it to have this quite wholesome message at the very end.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. But there's one last victory. Our friend, Jack not named, Jack Job, he makes it.
Yep.
He crashes through the movie theater at the end of the movie, finally joining the Muppets.
The timeline questions that this poses are perhaps too much for us to tackle here.
Yeah. Where's he
Has
been?
He been following them the whole time? Where did he come from? Where did he go? Where did he come from, Cotton Eye Joe? But but it is a nice little, this movie does a great job with having recurring bits or having bits that call back to earlier and sort of tying stuff together. And this is just that final button to the end of it where you thought we left a loose end, but we didn't. He's Mm-mm. back.
Oh, man, it's so good. And, you know, the credits are bananas. We get to see like someone like Sam Eagle, who's not really in this movie. He's just in the theater. You know, he gets a little credit, and as do some others. And this is how, you know, the world's favorite puppet gang, how they started. Now we know. We don't have to wonder anymore.
More or less. At the beginning, Kermit's nephew asked him, is this the story of the Muppets? And he goes, I think he says, more or less.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. It's a loose interpretation of events.
It's inspired by true events.
There you go. Perfect. All right. So that's the Muppet movie.
That it is. It is a beautiful little piece of television and movie history. And even though there are some parts that didn't age super well, and some humor that doesn't translate quite perfectly, I think that overall it does hold up remarkably well. And it's just a very sweet, clever film.
Mm-hmm. So next month, we'll be back with The Great Muppet Caper, a film from 1981. So just a couple years after this one. This is, out of this list, I think I've seen The Great Muppet Caper maybe only twice, so I'm not as familiar with this one, so I'm looking forward to talking through that next time.
Well, I'll see you next time, Steven. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Bye.